conversations today are dominated by the left table conspiracy. That's quite all right. I hope, by the way, that people are thinking about papers. I was talking with one of you earlier who had an interesting idea for a paper that hadn't occurred to me, and those are the best kind, of course. What?
Can I ask, I know it's on the syllabus, I think, but what are your parameters as far as, I know it's fairly
wide. The answer is that as long as you aren't planning to qualify for the paper requirement, what I really want is interesting thoughts about the implication of some technology that might change things lots in the next few decades, which is really what the book and the course are about. And it is, from my standpoint, more interesting the less I have thought about that particular technology, because I believe in exploiting my students and then they're exploiting me, and that means I got to learn stuff from what you write. So sort of from that standpoint, the ideal paper is saying, here is a technology, this is a description of it, of what we now know about it, here is what it might produce in the future, here are the issues that would raise. Now, you could combine that to the extent that some of this already exists with what is the legal status of the sort of opening wedge of this technology, as it were. And that's going to depend on how far future. If it's a really science fictional idea, if the technology is mind reading, you might be able to say, well, there are certain mind reading like things that we have now, like lie detectors, for example, what are the restrictions? But mostly it would be an exploration of the future. If it's something that's already beginning to happen, and the idea is it could become a whole lot more important, then you probably want to look at its current legal status, but then go on from there. So basically, it's sort of a combination of the kind of futurology which says, here is something interesting and different that might happen, and legal analysis to say, how will the legal system deal with it? How might it deal with it? What are the problems? Things of that sort. All right?
And if we are hoping to do the SARA...
In that case, you've got to do a version of this that includes more real current law than I would normally require. Right? That for doing that, it seems to me you have to sort of show you can write something like a law review article, at least at the appropriate level for you at this stage. And since my ideal article could be written by a non-law student who was an anthropologist or something, it might not qualify. All right? So I guess that's the basic distinction. Either is fine with me, but I want to learn stuff from your papers, sort of for the real measure.
Technically, how many pages do you have to
read? Up to you. I mean, if it's over 100 pages, I probably won't read it. If it's under one page, I doubt you'll have to be saying enough to be interesting. But I have one published economics article, which I think is under a page. And I, at one point, was discussing that with Jim Buchanan, who was a colleague of mine at VPI and who later got a Nobel Prize. And he said that he was working on his submission for the shortest publishable article in economics. And he was hoping to get it down to a sentence, but he hadn't done it yet. But mine was, I think, about half a page or not much more than that. I think it made a simple but real point about economics. So basically, to begin with, of course, pages are sort of meaningless nowadays anyway. If I were really going to give you a limit, it would have to be like characters or words or something, because you can make it as many pages as you like, but playing with fonts and margins and all the rest of that stuff. But really, it's just got to be long enough so that it really actually says interesting stuff. And you can see, I'm pretty sure that I've got for this, do I have on the webpage links to past papers? I think I do. So you can see at least, generally the papers I link to are the good ones. So you can see by those what sort of a range of papers that I thought did an adequate job of saying interesting things. Other questions? And the deadline is basically the last day of exam period, which I think is the last deadline I'm allowed to set. And that means you get an extra couple of days if your exams are over by then. Of course, that might be a disadvantage if you'd like to be going off to Bermuda for those couple of days, but I have no objection to your writing your final draft in Bermuda. You're welcome to submit stuff by email. I prefer to have my stuff by email. Hopefully, I'll even have an email program I can trust by then, but I'm not sure. The my email program for a long time was something called Eudora, which unfortunately got orphaned like 15 years ago and hasn't been supported since then. But it was a really nice email program. And the latest iteration of Apple's operating system doesn't, Eudora won't run under it. And somebody brought out something that purported to be a Eudora work-alike that was compatible with the new system, and I foolishly switched to it, and it has all sorts of bugs. And supposedly they're going to bring out the new version of it, which will fix everything in a little over a month, and if it doesn't, I'm switching to something else.
Do you want it in PDF or Word or...
Either of those is just fine. I can change it between those easily enough.
Okay.
Oh, let me warn, if any of you are ever doing things, you have to submit in PDF. The PDF produced by a DocX document in the current version of Mac Word has got things wrong with it. I tell you this because of horrible experiences. So if you have to do something in PDF from Word, save it as a doc format instead of a docx format, and then if you're using a Mac, I cannot speak to what Windows machines do, but I had all sorts of trouble with a self-published book before I realized that the problem was a defect of PDFs produced by that. Much too large, and the Adobe software that's supposed to work with PDFs won't handle them. So, warning. All right, so let's go back to our conspirators over in the corner. LJ, you want to read your question and then say what you think you have interesting to say about it.
Okay, so if one metaphor poorly expresses the function of a virtual transaction, how might a lawyer protect the client interest in a courtroom setting? Metaphors are powerful and potentially misleading if one does not understand the underlying process. One could imagine a scenario where the plaintiff or prosecutor gets to pitch the first metaphor and gets the court comparing the situation based on that metaphor, and then the defense, who will also need a metaphor to explain the virtual transactions, would be at a disadvantage. Perhaps metaphors are too dangerous for adversarial proceedings where the realities of the situation are far too abstract because of the technical nature of the interactions. So my idea with that is if you have, say, a cyber crime, and you have your prosecutor who is giving you a mental image to hold on to.
He stole their property.
Exactly. The problem is, as a defense attorney, if you are trying to rebut that, you can't then point to facts that are going to adequately show that jury, who is maybe not going to have the really strong understanding of the technical things that are going on there. You're not going to be able to explain to them like you would in a normal courtroom setting. Like, you know, this person didn't actually stab that person. They did this other thing. And you can't do
that.
They
didn't steal that stuff. It's still there.
Right. And so because of the primacy effect of the metaphor that you get first, I feel like a lot of times you deal with irreversible error because every time the prosecutor brings out that metaphor, it's too powerful. So how do we stop people from using these superpower metaphors to talk about tech when we have a society that doesn't understand what's going on behind the scenes and we can't do the mental work for a lot of people without these metaphors?
Seems to me there are two different questions here. One of them is for the defense attorney. If you are in this situation, how might you deal with it? And the other is for the legal system. And I'm not sure I see any attractive solution for the legal system, but if you have one, by all means, tell us. What legal rules could you imagine that would prevent this problem from occurring?
Well, I think for one thing, mandating jury instructions would help. Explaining to jurors that the prosecution and the defense are limited by, like, maybe give a jury instruction that resembles the opening statements in your chapter on metaphors, explaining to them that metaphors are not, there's no good replacement for these things. We need them to think about the way that we deal with technology. We need to think about it as looking at a document and imagining that as a piece of paper. We need to see the screen as a screen, not as pixels, and we need to talk about desktop computers, not device that is a computer that sits on your desktop. But these informalities that we have to use, it's because it helps us understand. But that doesn't mean that you should be swept away in them and let them replace what you understand to be going on, and to sort of reserve your judgment and try to understand the processes without
So you want to do it as a general jury instruction about metaphors rather than by an explanation that when they talk about breaking into a computer, what really happened was, or when they talk about stealing stuff, please note that it's really copying, you think?
Well, I think that the defense will want to say that stuff, but the problem is because prosecutors get the shot first, and,
yes,
and same thing for plaintiffs. They get their first opportunity to make an impression, and it's in their interest to have it sound like a break-in or to have it sound
right,
like, you know, this nefarious activity. So by the time the defense person gets up there, the damage is done. People have already made, you know, they're not supposed to, but they've
right,
made some judgments. So I think the curative jury instruction would help people to understand, you know, there are two interpretations for what's happening here. Some interpretations are metaphors. They're not going to properly describe the transaction that's really
right,
taking place. And so you need to keep an open mind and be willing to truly hear what that defense attorney is.
Something else you might want to think about, though it's not the primary business of lawyers, but that's propaganda. That is to say, suppose your client is a firm that's on one side or another of certain controversies. If you are clever about how you frame the problem, you might get people thinking about the issue in terms of your metaphor in terms instead of somebody else's metaphor, and thus make it easier in the future for your client to win cases or to persuade people or things of that sort. That it seems to me that you're looking at it in the trial context, which is certainly one important context, and it does seem to me that, maybe I'm wrong, that it's more likely that your question is a useful one for a defense attorney to sort of think in advance about when he, you know, you said that my client stole your client's documents. Where are the documents now? Does your client no longer have them? And, you know, sort of try to phrase it in those terms. And also thinking in advance of whether you've got a convincing metaphor that, I mean, I think later on one of you is, or maybe somebody else was talking, I guess, I think one of you was talking later about the DDoS attacks. And if you imagine a DDoS attack that doesn't use illegitimately seized computers, imagine the kind of DDoS attack where you tell all of your fellow believers in whatever your ideology or it is, let's all access the website at such and such a time. You could certainly think of that in terms, some of which sound like an attack and one of which sound like a perfectly legitimate action, you know, say, which just as if we decided to get a big crowd in front of his front door in order that people coming to, suppose you're anti-abortion, you said what all our DDoS attack on the pro-abortion website was like our having a rally in front of an abortion center. And it's true that women coming in to get abortions will be embarrassed by that, but that's our freedom of speech. We're entitled to do it. It seems to me that you could put your DDoS in that form, and somebody else would say, no, 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 it's more like you put a padlock on our door. So I think it is worth thinking about metaphors as a sort of almost a technology, and a rhetorical technology, really, because that's really in part at least of what it is. All right, my next question is mine, and that's one which at least I think is interesting, and that's what legal rules provide the best incentive for self-protection by private parties, such as hospitals or utility companies, against online terrorist attacks? The best incentives to report attacks. Do other people have thoughts on that? Let me suggest that there are two sets of legal rules you might want to think about. One of them are the legal rules with regard to the attacker, so that you could imagine, for example, saying that an online attack is a crime. You could imagine saying it's a tort. You could imagine saying it's not illegal at all. Maybe you could think about other possibilities. The other set is, what are the legal responsibilities of the victim? If I have a website which has a lot of credit card numbers on it, and somebody succeeds in accessing my website without my permission and copies 10,000 credit card numbers, what are my obligations to the holders of those credit card numbers? And there you could imagine, again, you could think of my fault in letting them commit that crime against me. You could say, I've got no obligation. After all, they broke the law. It's their fault. You could say that I have an obligation in tort, but only under a negligence rule. so that if I took reasonable precautions, the fact that in spite of reasonable precautions they got in doesn't make me liable. Or you could say I'm strictly liable. I had those credit card numbers. It was my legal responsibility to guard them. And you can imagine, on both of those dimensions, different legal rules, and then it's sort of fun to try to think about the effects. So suppose we start with the rules with regard to the attacker. Suppose the rule is, take the extreme case, suppose there's no law against it. Suppose that from the standpoint of the law, if you can manage to trick my computer into giving information I don't want it to give, tough luck, that was my fault for not properly protecting my computer. What is my incentive to self-protect now? How strong or weak?
Strong,
because no one else is protecting me, right? They're going to keep doing it. Right? Unless it does no harm. I mean, obviously, but we're assuming, obviously, if the break-in does no harm, we don't worry about it. What is my incentive to make public the fact that I've suffered a break-in?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Sure. Suppose it's not illegal for somebody to access my computer against my permission and get stuff out of it. What incentive, how strong is my incentive when it happens to let people know?
Strong as you would need to repair your own damage. So if you needed a consultant or you needed to host your bug to try to get solutions.
Then I might have to say, suppose I intend to try to deal with it myself. Keep my mouth quiet because I don't want people to know that my system is vulnerable. I don't want to look incompetent. If I've lost other people's information, I'd much rather they not find out about it. As you may know, there's just been a story that WikiLeaks has leaked a bunch of stuff from Stratfor, which is a company that apparently is a sort of a private intelligence agency that tries to gather information to sell to companies and government agencies and so forth. And apparently they succeeded in breaking into Stratfor's computers. Somebody did. Now, I think WikiLeaks received the information from other people who broke in some months ago, and Stratfor shut down their website for a notable period of time while repairing it to make it safe, and Stratfor claims we lost nothing of any importance. But that was sort of an interesting case where they did admit it had happened. I don't know why they did or didn't, why they had to. But nonetheless, you can see that on the one hand, making it legal would give strong incentives for self-defense, but on the other hand, probably few incentives to share the information. And you could imagine maybe a bunch of potential victim companies might have a deal where they said, we'll keep each other's secrets, but if someone broke into you, tell us about it so we can prevent it. Maybe they wouldn't, but next, suppose it's tort. Suppose what we say is if you break in, people can sue you in tort. Now what are their incentives? And what might it depend on? What's the obvious critical question on the effect of tort liability? What? Well, that's true of all of them. But in the particular case of tort, what's the question you ask even before you ask whether or not we can prove it? How much money what? How much damage was done to us is one question. What's the other one? How much you can recover, that's right. But imagine the rule is in tort, and we've suffered $17 million worth of damage from a bright high school kid. All right? Well, the possibility of recovering damages is not a very strong incentive for doing anything in that case. Ditto if it's, you know, some foreign source that we're going to have a very hard time accessing. Yep?
Well, I mean, not necessarily, because if you sued that 17-year-old for all he was worth, you know, even though you may not get very strong recovery, at least you've set this pretty intense precedent that this company, if you try to hack into it, they're going to take everything you have.
That might be worth something, but everything he has isn't very much. So it's not going to hurt him very much either. Most 17-year-olds don't have very large assets.
But if you didn't go after somebody just because they didn't have assets, then all the people that didn't have assets would start going after you.
But I was thinking, yeah, but they'll still go after you because they aren't going to lose anything. What I was thinking of is criminal versus tort. That one of the arguments for the criminal punishment is you can lie, maybe 17-year-old, and we have some problems with minors, but an 18-year-old, you can lock him up for 5 years if that's the punishment. So that on the one hand, tort damages, you could argue that tort damages, if you assume that the tortfeasor has money, reduce your incentive to self-protect, because after all, I'm going to get recovery. If you assume he doesn't have money, you still have the same incentive to self-protect with no damages, but you have a fairly weak incentive to go after him unless you think you can recover. Still some, as you're saying, because you still want to establish it by for deterrence, but it would be more effective from that standpoint with criminal. That suggests one possibility, which I've speculated about in other contexts, namely is various sort of criminal tort hybrids. So imagine a system where you have a tort suit for certain kinds of offenses, offenses that might be criminal or might be tort, and if you win the case and he can't pay, he gets a criminal punishment. And maybe even he gets a criminal punishment and the state pays you the damages. That would be a sort of a hybrid bounty tort criminal system. And that would at least have the attraction that you could punish people who didn't have money that you could collect. It would have the attraction that you, the victim, would have a strong incentive to announce that it had happened in order that you could get your case. One disadvantage is it slightly reduces your incentive to protect because you hope to get some compensation. And you could carry it even further. One of the societies that were, I think I've mentioned it briefly here that I discussed in my other seminar, is 18th century England, where criminal punishment was privately prosecuted. So that's the system where when somebody robs you, there aren't any police to call. They haven't invented the police force yet. There isn't a public prosecutor. The only public prosecutors working for the crown are for prosecuting people who actually steal stuff from the government. So in that system, when someone robs you, it's up to you to figure out who did it, get the evidence, go to a constable to arrest him, and then prosecute him. But one thing you get out of that is deterrence, your point before, because the punishments are criminal. You hang him. That's a pretty strong reason not to rob you, well, not to rob you. So I'm just trying to think sort of beyond the normal limits of our system about possible legal rules that you could have for dealing with this. Yeah.
It would be an interesting thing in the tort criminal hybrid. In the case you mentioned that, say, some company that is responsible for a number of credit cards, let's say that there's a contributory
negligence,
negligence and liability through that. So now, even if you have someone that's judgment proof, you still have these victims, whoever had these things stolen, where now the company is still financially responsible for them, so the incentive to protect is increased, but everybody is protected.
The incentive to protect is high because it means they suffer a large loss, but the incentive to reveal is low if they hope to be able to get away with not revealing. Right. If they can claim, well, we think they tried to break in, but we don't think they got anything, and depending on the circumstances, that may or may not be a plausible story that they can tell. One hears sort of rumors that there are various successful computer crimes that never get reported because banks and people like that would rather lose $1 million than be known to be vulnerable. And I don't know if it's really true or not. But we're now switching over to my second question, which is the legal status of the victim vis-a-vis his victims, so to speak. That is, so you've got a web... You have a server which has got people's credit card numbers. Somebody succeeds in breaking into it and downloading that information. What's your liability? Anybody know what it is now? Because I don't. Is it negligence? Is it strict liability? Is it nothing? How about for victims of crimes in general? That's an interesting question. Suppose you're a hotel guest. And somebody, when you're out, gets into your room and steals your property. Is the hotel liable? Anyone know?
Probably not. The room safes, they always say in the room safe, we're not responsible for anything that can be stolen out of your room safe,
That's out of your room safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you could imagine... a website which says, I don't think I've noticed any saying this, but I do know that there are lots of websites where you have the option of asking them to keep your credit card information or not. And the advantage of trying to keep it, you don't have to enter it in the next time, and the disadvantage is there. So I wonder if a website could plausibly argue, look, we gave you the option, that made it obvious what the risk was. You chose to accept the risk of having your credit card numbers on our machine, on our server. Tough luck, somebody broke in, your credit card numbers are out. Yeah. No, I don't know what the law is on that, but it does seem to me that there are real space equivalents to the question of to what extent other people are required to protect against crimes those whose property they're holding. How about a safe deposit box? What if you've got property in a bank safe deposit box and somebody blows, great bank robbery, they get into the safe deposit stuff, they crack it all open, they loot your stuff. Does the bank owe you for the money? Yeah.
I was reading something in another class I'm in, and it's like they had an example, or I think it might have actually been a case, someone that I guess is like night deposit drops, where you put like a bag of money into a deposit drop, and the bank found the bag, but there was no money in it, and they had tried to like disclaim liability for that, and like under UCC, that would be
so from that standpoint, once you would put it where they said to put it, you were liable. Yeah?
To my knowledge, the bank is not liable for it, and the bank encouraged them to do it by the money
cash. So you think they're not liable?
Yeah, they're not liable. They're only, where certificate documents.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, not jewelry, not cash.
I thought part of the point of safe deposit boxes was that was where you put the jewelry you were afraid was going to be stolen.
Yeah, I tried to get involved in the jewelry box. That's what they told me.
That's
no jewelry, no cash.
It's interesting. Yeah. So what they're doing is disclaiming liability by contract, presumably. Yeah. Yes. Sorry, somebody else was saying something. No. Anyway, all right, I guess the point is really you can imagine a range of possible legal rules with both advantages and disadvantages. All right, let me see. I think renowned PYS is not here, alas, being a previous year student, so I'll read it for our invisible PYS. Useful information. Microsoft actively maintains a software package called Computer Online Forensic Evidence Extractor, COFFEE. A set of utilities designed to help law enforcement gather forensic data from suspects' computers. Is this a betrayal of their customers, some of whom are going to be suspects? Hackers responded by releasing DCAF, a program designed to interfere with the operation of COFFEE on a given machine. This is an example of the technological arms race between private citizens and the government. Should tools like DCAF, designed specifically to thwart law enforcement, be illegal? Why or why not?
Yeah. I don't think so. I think that an arms race like this helps to increase the share of knowledge, ultimately, and really human ability. And while in this one case, this one program may be used for what some people view as a sinister ends, but that doesn't mean that down the line, that same program or some derivative of it won't be used for some commonly
Would you argue on similar bases that devices designed to help people break out of jail, say, ought to be entirely legal because, after all, the research might later yield mining equipment or...
When I think about some of the criminal procedure cases they've got on the Fourth Amendment, like the heating sensor lamps or the planes flying over in public airspace, I kind of analogize it to this, and I think that this is okay, because if you think about the heating lamps, if you wanted to, make your apartment really cold, or if there's a bug, you can turn on water so law enforcement can't hear, or I think in the one where the plane flew over, they always said that you could put an awning over your backyard so that no one can see in, and all of those would be permissible measures. So I guess in this case, it just seems wrong because it's tailored exactly.
Isn't that even closer analogy at the moment being radar detectors?
Yeah.
The radar detectors are a technology which is illegal in some but not all states, as I understand it, designed to thwart law enforcement. It's designed to let drivers drive faster than the speed limit without getting caught. That's not what they say, but that's obviously the purpose of a radar detector. So should they be illegal or not? That is, you want to argue that it's a useful competition of technologies, even if some is used for sinister purposes. Is there another argument? Is there any other argument for it? Let's go back from it. Why are we in favor of the Fourth Amendment anyway?
Well,
Maybe we should just repeal it. After all, clearly the Fourth Amendment makes the job of police harder. We hire police to do the job. So what's this nonsense about not letting them do the job properly by being able to search anything anytime they want? Anybody? Yeah.
I think it's a level of privacy of like what we hold today, or a level of privacy of what we're comfortable with. If we didn't have like that much around privacy, I mean, it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Plus beyond that, it's about having a system of checks and balances so that one party doesn't have absolute power in a situation. There's somebody standing behind them supervising, because that's what our whole government is based on, is having one group checking another group.
Other comments?
I agree with that. I also just think that if we're going to call ourselves a free society, a lot of what we've determined through legislatures and things are these laws are things that we've agreed to give up these certain freedoms to be in the society. And I don't really think that they should be allowed to really, really snip that out at like using the most extreme types of technology if I don't get to do the same thing. You know, it doesn't make sense, and I think it just comes down to like one party having absolute power or not.
Yeah. I would have said that seems to be the underlying argument is that we don't in fact trust the police or anybody else, and that one way of putting the argument is to say if the police have only a limited ability to enforce the law, then the worse the law is, the harder a time they'll have enforcing it. Whereas police with really unlimited abilities can enforce very bad laws, and that we're more scared of the downside of that than of the flip side of their being unable to enforce good laws. I think that's at least part of what underlies a lot of these restrictions on what police can do. But Now, a different argument, one which is even closer to yours, is to say that there isn't really a sharp line between technologies designed to foil law enforcement and technologies designed to do other things. And that if you make radar detectors illegal, one thing that might happen, I don't know if it has, is people coming up with devices that are radar detectors among other things. That if you think about, for example, the old issue of copying copy-protected disks back when there were copy-protected floppy disks, back when some floppy disks were actually floppy. I don't know if any of you are old enough to be familiar with such antique devices, but they were actually floppy disks that you could bend with your hands. They didn't have solid things around them. But anyway, back in those days, if they had decided that it was illegal to have software just designed to copy floppy disks, the obvious solution would be utility software, which did lots of things, including copying disks that were damaged in one way or another and therefore hard to copy. And some of those are the ones that were where the damage was deliberate by the people who created the disk to make it uncopyable. And you can see that for many of these things, I don't know if there is some plausible device to where you have one setting and it detects radar, and another setting and it does something else useful, but you could imagine something like that. So a different argument would be that it's hard to draw lines, although probably not always. But let me take the next one, which is, again, a little bit like my earlier question about liabilities. What liability should accrue to the various parties involved with a particular DDoS attack? The party launching the attack? The party who wrote the code that enabled the attack? The hosting site containing the files loaded onto the zombie machines, the owners of the zombies. Do the owners of the zombies have a cause of action against the other parties? What are their damages, assuming that the zombie only runs the DDoS code when the CPU is idle and there is no permanent charge for internet connection? This was written a long time ago. Should it matter whether they also allow their machine to be a zombie for benign purposes, e.g. SETI analysis? Does it occur to anybody that he's left out one liability question? How about the liability of the owners of the zombies? This is really the same question I had a moment ago, for allowing their machines to be used to shut down someone else's website. Do people understand what the technology is that's being described? I'm not sure if everybody is familiar. What's going on is, I want to be able to shut down his website because I don't like him or don't like his politics or whatever. I know that if I could only get 50,000 computers to simultaneously try to read his website, it would overload the ability of his web, his server, to fulfill those requests, or people wouldn't be able to see it. Make sense so far? Right? What's happening when you're browsing the web is you're sending a message to a server saying, send me document X, which is the HTML document that's the web page. And the server is sending you document X. The server has some limited capacity. So if enough people per second are asking to be sent documents, it stops sending them. That's a DDoS attack. How do I do it? Well, one way is if I have 100,000 friends, all of whom agree with me that he's slimeball and ought to have his website shut down. I say, hey boys, noon tomorrow, let's start telling all our computers to try to read his website. And sure enough, it shuts down. I don't have 100,000 friends. Ah, but I've got some really good programmers. So what do? We write a virus or some piece of malicious code. We write a useful little program that lots of people would like to have, which has some undocumented features. And the undocumented feature is that once you've got it on your machine, I can send a message to it, which will result in its telling your machine to access his website. All right? Your machine is now a zombie. That is, your machine is now one which is acting on my orders to access his website, not on your orders to do what you think it's supposed to be doing. All right? So if my virus or malicious program or whatever it is has gotten downloaded by 100,000 people, which sounds like a lot, but it's a very small fraction of all the computers out there, then when I send out my instruction, Zoom, all 100,000 of those take just an instant away from what they're doing for their owners to try to access his website, and his website in effect crashes. All right, that's the technology that's being described. Any questions? Yeah.
I think I mentioned this before. I think the owners of the zombies could probably mount some sort of class action suit if they could find out who their fellow class members are, to make it a class, for trespass to chattels. Because my understanding is that just for using or intermeddling with a computer system, even if it's not damaging, I think the standard is very low for trespass to chattels. That could be their civil cause of action.
I think you're correct, but I don't think it's going to be very useful because I suspect that this will be done by people who are doing it anonymously.
Yeah,
I think you're right legally. Legally speaking, I think that if Romney was so foolish as to publicly announce that he was using viruses to seize 100,000 zombies to shut down his opponent's website, I think you are perfectly right that the owners of those zombies, if they could identify themselves, would have a class action against him. But if it's done by anonymous is anonymous, and you're going to have a very hard time, I think, figuring out who did it and proving it.
I also heard this morning, apparently, some of the people that, I guess, launched attacks after the SOPA announcement, they did, like, a similar thing called a DDoS attack, and it overloaded the servers, like, government servers, physically damaging the servers, and the government was making...
I don't believe it.
...claims about property damage.
Yeah. I think if they physically damage the servers, the government ought to be suing whoever set up their servers for, for something, because...
Well, I don't know.
Then, look, say, as is pointed out in some of the later questions, exactly the same thing from the server standpoint could happen for an entirely non-malicious reason. Let's suppose I put up a blog post yesterday. Let's suppose that a couple of really high-profile blogs, their authors notice my blog post and say, hey, isn't that neat? Let's tell people about it.
Oh, yeah.
100,000 people read it. Every one of those people goes to access my website. Funny thing, shuts down. All right? So that's the equivalent. That the term is slash dotting, I think, that. But that's the case. I spent a while earlier today doing something I sometimes do, which is searching the web to see if people are talking about me. One of the ways of wasting time that's now made possible by modern technology. And indeed, I put up a blog post a day or two ago, and there are probably 5 or 10 websites I have found which have links to my blog post because they agree with what I'm saying and want to point people at it, basically. Well, if instead of 5 or 10 that were 100 or 1,000, or if a few of them were very, very popular sites, might shut down the server that my, probably not my blog. I suspect that my server, the server my blog is on, probably belongs to Google, and I suspect they have an awful lot of capacity. buttons since I use Blogspot, which I think is a Google product. But you can certainly see in principle it could happen. So that makes it that part of it is sort of tricky. And so I think any decently built piece of hardware, when it receives too many requests, it stops fulfilling them. But I don't know. I haven't seen these news stories. But they could certainly make other complaints, because after all, shutting down a website which is producing a useful service, you know, doesn't have to damage the computer. Suppose somebody does a DDoS attack on a commercial website on Amazon. All right, and Amazon loses $50 million worth of sales during the 8 hours it's down. That's a legitimate injury, it seems to me. But it does raise the question, suppose it wasn't malicious. Suppose that there is something on Amazon that looks really interesting, and so a number of people point at it and the result is it shuts down. I think you'd have a very hard time winning that case, but I may be wrong.
Yes.
What?
Target actually went down. Because what they're doing, like, as promotions lately, is that they're having, like, designers with these, like, low-end clothing, I suppose, if you want. And the Sony actually released Target. And on that day, so many people hit the Target website and shut the site down for one
right.
day. It's a Cyber Monday. So, with us, is it, like, a Cyber Monday? It was just, like, because they launched, like, designer things times a year, and they just weren't prepared, like, for that particular designer thing. Bad thing, so it shut the whole site down, and they got like a lot of bad press for it, a lot of, you know, unhappy customers because it screwed up the whole system. Some of them that did take the order, because I shut down, the orders got canceled, so they thought they bought stuff that they didn't have. So, I mean, it was like a huge mess. I don't know if anybody pursued any action necessarily, but it was like, so that didn't really design a big deal, but I mean, it created like chaos.
Have any of you read the Larry Niven story, Flash Crowd? Larry Niven is maybe the best idea person, certainly one of the best idea people in modern science fiction. And this is a story in a future where they've got transporter booths, where you can go from one place to another by stepping into something like a phone booth and dialing the right thing, and now you're in something like a phone booth, you know, 3,000 miles away. So it's an instant transportation. And it's fun. In a sense, it's my kind of thing, and that particular one, I think, is a vanishingly, extraordinarily unlikely technology. But it's still fun to say, if you had that technology, what would happen? And one of Niven's ideas is the real space equivalent of what we've been talking about, a flash crowd, where there's a news story saying that there is a pink tide on some beach somewhere, and 100,000 people read it, and 10,000 of them all want to instant transport to the booths where the pink tide is supposed to be coming in, and they try to do so, and nobody can leave because the booths keep being filled with incoming people. So you've got all these people stuck here at the flash crowd. And then sort of as the story goes on, if I remember correctly, some criminals realize the opportunity because you're suddenly dumping 10,000 people in a small area which isn't expecting them. And so you start getting a riot, and you can take advantage of the riot to break into jewelry stores and steal stuff. And if you're a little cleverer, you can figure out how to create a flash crowd, only you're there first waiting for, and so forth and so on. It's quite a fun exploration, as they say, in the style of, I think, what we're doing, except with an unlikely technology, of some of the possible implications. But the non-malevolent equivalent of DDoS is a flash crowd phenomenon, only it's a virtual rather than a real one. So my guess is that, in fact, the party launching the attack is liable if you can find out who he is, but you can't. The party who wrote the code that enabled the attack, that's trickier, because in one sense, the code that enabled the attack is Firefox. It's whatever browser the machine is doing it on. But you also, somebody had to do the code to take over those computers. And then the question, yeah?
Oftentimes, it's something done to point out the flaw in Firefox. So it's done for a good purpose, and then it's publicized. People don't patch their computers.
Yeah, I was thinking of Firefox not as a flaw, but as the fact that when the zombie tries to access his website, he uses Firefox to do it. But you're perfectly right that you could certainly imagine a case. That's an interesting point. Let us suppose that I discover that there is a weakness in the Mac operating system, which could be exploited by somebody wanting to take over a Mac. Now, what do I do, and what are the legal implications? So one thing I could do is to write Apple. But Apple may not pay any attention. You know, there are lots of people out there. How do they know if I'm confident or if it's serious? Maybe it's just a nut case. Well, another thing that would be quite tempting to do is to publicize it, put up on my webpage, and say, all right, now Apple's going to have to fix it. But, of course, if Apple is slow to fix it, some enterprising person might take advantage of that particular bug in order to get control of a lot of Macs and do some bad thing, whatever it is. So that, I mean, that is an interesting issue. It's not one we were really discussing here, but maybe we should have been. What is the legal status of people who discover holes? And maybe you could say that maybe a sensible rule would be they've got to report it to Apple first, and if Apple does nothing in 24 hours, they're entitled to make it public. So that would be possible. Yep. What?
Aren't they protected by First Amendment?
It's an interesting question. I don't think the First Amendment protects me if I publish other people's credit card numbers, does it? Does it protect me from being criminally or civilly liable for having done it? First Amendment certainly doesn't protect me if I slander people. So it isn't an absolutely blank check to say anything. And the question is, if I suppose, that's an interesting question, suppose that somehow, without betraying any legal obligation, I discover the combination to a bank's combination lock. All right? It's going to be a special case if I'm a disloyal employee, but I'm not a disloyal employee. I just happen to be standing there when some really careless employee opened their safe with me watching. And it just happens to have a very good memory. I now know that combination. Any legal consequences if I publish it? Probably not. I don't think so, but I don't know. Because that's getting in the stereo.
I think it's pretty easy to assume that if you publish the bank code or the credit card number, that people will misuse it.
That would be the argument, of course.
I don't know. I feel like that's a... I don't think you're as safe as you would be if you're just talking about little things.
Though in my computer's case, I could say, well, I had a perfectly good reason to do it. Because someone else is going to discover it, and if they have a secret, they can use it, whereas if I make it public, that'll allow Apple to fix the problem. If
or they'll fix their own machine, potentially.
Maybe, yeah, depending on what it is. Sure, that's right. I could, of course, make it public along with instructions, and that sometimes happens. People sometimes say, you know, the workaround for this particular thing is to disable this or that feature of your computer until the software gets patched. That's something that sometimes happens. So,
in terms of trade secret law, if your information is ever published on the internet, even on like the dark recesses of Zanga where nobody lives anymore, and like it's there for like 30 seconds, it's still no longer a trade secret because it's been on the internet and because technically it was accessible by the right people.
I don't know about the internet case. The normal trade secret rule, as you probably know, is that you have to make reasonable efforts to protect the information in order that you can then sue anybody under trade secret law. My guess is that it would be a decision for the court as to what counted as reasonable efforts, but I don't really know. The case I do know about, which has this characteristic, except it wasn't in the darkest recesses of the internet, is a Scientology case. I don't know if people, I don't know how much you'll know about the Church of Scientology, which is one of the weirder institutions of the early 21st century. I like to say that the Church of Scientology is a religion, a science fiction story, and a con game. And you need all of those elements to understand it. But the con game is the follow, which you could argue is the same con game used by psychiatrists for a long time, but they were much more respectable, is that the Church of Scientology claims they've got a way of removing the metal blocks that keep you from being a Superman. And this involves you're holding a sort of a lie detector-like thing while they talk with you. So any similarity to psychoanalysis is purely coincidental. And furthermore, if you go through, you have to pay for this, by the way. It wouldn't work if you didn't pay it for some reason. And if you go through enough of this, you're now qualified to be on the other side and to charge other people for listening to them while they tell them things that are going to remove the metal blocks that will turn them into Superman. But you might think that at this point you're finished, but you're not. Because then they have a second layer, maybe a third layer, of deeper and darker information that if you get will make you a Superman. And some of this information takes the form of what are essentially secret scriptures. These are sort of the story of the sort of science fiction story behind various bizarre things. And if you learn enough of these, which costs you a great deal to do, you should be able to levitate and probably live forever and all sorts of other wonderful things. So, anyway, I don't know the details of the claim, but they're in that direction. So how do they do it? They keep these scriptures literally chained to the desks in the reading rooms, and you then pay to access them. And some people somehow got access to them. I don't know if they photographed the pages, but some equivalent of that, and put them up on the internet. And the Church of Scientology sued under trade secret law, which I thought was just beautiful. They said, our secret scriptures are a trade secret. And they were right, almost, because they're a source of money. They charge large amounts of money to read them. Their being a source of money depends on their being secret. If they're public, people will be able to read them without paying the money. They were almost certainly abstracted wrongfully, because anybody who had access to them had probably agreed not to copy them. I don't know how they do it, but let's assume they did. But they lost the case on the grounds they failed to protect them. They had now been on the internet, therefore they were now not a secret, therefore for other people to keep doing stuff with them was not a violation of trade secret law. So that was one of the early and interesting cases.
Yep. But the person that had initially put them on the internet was liable. But once he could use as a defense that now they are commonly known.
But did anybody know who actually put them on?
Yeah, it was one guy that was in there.
Really?
We only just went through.
That's interesting. I just know that.
One guy, and they said, look, you're the one that put it on the internet. These were trade secret at one point. They're not anymore, but you can't now say that.
So was he liable? Was he liable for damages?
He was, but then they also, there was a whole thing about they really hadn't defined that secret very well for obvious reasons, because it's better sacred religious text, so they didn't want to talk about it too much. But yeah. That, but yes, he essentially was.
But he's still alive.
As far as I know.
I'm surprised. But my impression is that the COS has a very broad view of the remedies available for them to use. But what? Yeah, they're a little scary, but they're also interesting. And they actually run quite an attractive, weird public school up in, I think, Oregon or Washington or once. On some occasion or other, I was giving a talk in somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and the people who had arranged for the talk told me that there was a private school in their area which sometimes also had talks by the people who were giving talk, and would I be willing to do one there too? And, you know, I'm interested in education, and so I did, and it turned out to be a private school run by Church of Scientology. That I think what's going on is that they're really hardcore people, don't want to spend time taking care of their own children, and so this is sort of a boarding school for their children. But it was a private school run on what struck me as quite an interesting alternative theory of education, with a whole lot more self-study and a whole lot less classroom than the standard model. The kids were bright, interesting kids. It was an interesting talk to give. My guess is that the model was really invented by the guy who ran the school, although he credited all of it to the founder of Scientology. But I certainly probably would not have agreed to do it if I had known that that was what the school was, given that they're not safe people to deal with, I think. But anyway, too much digression. All right, let's go back to LJ.
So this question is sort of talking about like the benign sort of cybercrime alternatives.
Yes.
So in opposition to having a DDoS attack, or my other example was the CPU theft, you could have something like SETI, which was mentioned in the reading, or you could have slash dotting, which is like if Reddit or Facebook, like if you're liking George Takei and then you click on his link and everybody clicks on his link, then that website at some point in the day might get slash dotted, which means it goes down, but not because somebody wants it to go down, but because everybody wants to see it. So the fact that those phenomena are occurring on a benign level, I feel like that... Can we use that to sort of call attention to these issues and get people to be more active in how they respond to them in, admittedly, non-legal ways? Like, there's maybe not a legal solution to this per se, but maybe a social solution. So, say I wanted to rent out my CPU, I could possibly make a profit by choosing to be active in my in how I treat my computer as opposed to passive and wait to have it stolen. that would make me responsible for it, which I think would have a deterrent effect, because if I'm a consumer and I don't know much about computers and suddenly society is telling me I need to understand more and then I would be liable for what I do understand, my response to that probably initially would be to say, I don't, peace out, I don't want to know anything. But I think if you created positive alternatives, like say you can make a profit from your CPU, or you can start to find solutions to splash dotting, say, for your personal website, that, I think, would probably create a motivation.
Suppose slash dotting becomes enough of a problem so that it's worth third parties trying to find solutions. You could imagine, and I'm not sure quite how you would do it, if I've got some way of spotting it when it starts to happen. Suppose that I simply monitor the 1,000 most watched locations on the internet, and anytime two or more of them have a link to the same place, an alarm rings. And when an alarm rings, I promptly try to contact the owner of the place in question and say, look, how would you like to borrow a couple of extra servers for the next few hours? I've got these servers at a very moderate price. You can copy your site to them. And one out of four requests will go to your site, and the others will go to these three servers, and thus your site will only be down for 3 seconds. I don't know if that would work, but I'm wondering if they're money. You don't think it's going to work?
I don't think so, because the time when you would be like copying your site on the other side, you're losing time right here already. You might bring your site back up faster.
Yes, that's what.
Make sure that you have everything there.
Well, except that what I was imagining is if you could anticipate it somehow if I say because I don't know, it'd be interesting to sort of investigate. There may be a sort of a cascade effect in the sense that a link to a certain really interesting thing appears on one popular website. People who read that, some of them have websites, so they put up links. People who read that, if that was the kind of cascade, you could somehow pick up the cascade early enough, 15 minutes before it got reached critical. I'm not sure any of that is workable, but I think it's at least an intriguing idea to think about whether some of the problems that are both criminal and benign, as it were, would have technological solutions of that sort.
Well, I was just thinking, and I do not understand server technology that well, so maybe I'm not the first one to speak to this, but I feel like especially if you had a site where your intent was to sort of go viral, and you sort of, your dream is to have this massive onslaught of hits, maybe you could in advance set up a system where you have a set number of servers day to day, but you have like an automatic elastic system that when you go viral, like when you reach a certain critical mass of hits before your servers go down, but far more than you would normally be used to, then you send a message out to, like, yes, please subscribe me to these extra servers.
Yep. That's an interesting idea. It's sort of almost like a form of insurance.
Yeah.
Where you pay some small annual fee in exchange for which there's a little bit of software on your server, which notices when the level of requests is approaching a critical level and automatically copies its content to the backup servers that are sitting there that somebody has and diverts some of the requests.
The only problem,
though, is for something like Amazon, when they host a website, that's exactly what they do. It's thousands. So they can just do it in real time. If your site's being told, it's distributed.
When you say when Amazon hosts, what are you thinking of?
So Amazon, they have, it's called Amazon Web Services.
Uh-huh.
So you can put your server there, and so you don't buy anything. You're just renting their CPUs.
But they have an Yeah. Well, as I was saying, my blog is on Blogspot, which I think belongs to Google. And my guess is, from what I know of Google, that they probably are already set up so that when tomorrow, by great good fortune, a million people want to read my blog, a million people will get to read my blog.
I think it got a lot of press because Target switched from Amazon right before that happened.
Huh, that's interesting.
Okay, because I was actually shocked that Target went down to, again, a well established online business already has distribution, but they have sales recovery. The fact that Target went down, I was shocked.
If you get flooded by, like, if you're purchasing these extra servers, that I'm assuming that would cost you more, right?
Not very much, though.
Not very much? Oh, okay.
Because you're not purchasing the servers. You're purchasing the option of using the servers in the 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 chance that you need them, right?
My concern would be if you have... had people using those systems, then the DDoS attacks would be more volatile, because theoretically, if you set up a complex system of zombies to just straight up machine gun a website to the point where they had to be operating it.
It would take more zombies to do it if such systems existed.
Right. But I feel like there's maybe no limit to how many zombies you could put on, but I don't know. I think there might be a counterpoint on the DDoS side if you did implement such a system.
Let me see if I can restate your point, because it's an interesting point. Suppose we can't stop DDoS attacks, but there are only a few malevolent people who will do them, who have the ability to do them. In that case, as things now stand, in order to do them, they've got to get 10,000 zombies. If we improved our defenses, they'd have to get 100,000 zombies. But they could. And now that would mean 10 times as many people whose machines are getting interfered with. So that could be a conceivable case. It seems it's a little unlikely. It's sort of like worrying that if people have locks on the doors, then burglars will use sledgehammers, and that'll have bad consequences or something. But yeah. All right, let me... I think the next one, I think, is yours as well, and is related to this, but not the same one.
Yes. So, in terms of dealing with the benign versus the malevolent, how would we develop legal rules that just test that intent? Because most of the time you're dealing with anonymous. And
well, but which one? Let's take SETI. Isn't distinguishing SETI from a CPU thief pretty easy?
I would think so, because SETI would be able to say, look, we have this legitimate purpose. But
it's not a legitimate purpose, it's because SETI has your permission.
Right.
Right.
They've agreed to it.
That's right. So it seems to me that for the CPU case, it's pretty easy, that you can easily enough say, are they or are they not doing it with your permission? And just like the difference between trespass and renting land, right? Yeah?
But who actually reads the licensing agreements? It could be buried in licensing agreements somewhere. You grant us permission to do X number of computations per hour to allow computer time.
So there
is. Yeah, exactly. So
would
it be
the fact? That is, there is a potential question of whether or not it really counts as a contract or whether it really counts as a send and so forth, which exists in lots and lots of different contexts.
I think that would go in a gray area, because I feel like you could get their assent, but then somebody who's not very good with their computer, say you install something on their computer, initially with their permission,
yeah,
that they can't figure out how to get rid of, and it's just eating up all their CPU, and it's actually something fairly malevolent. But you have that appearance of, I got permission.
But it seems to me your second case is a much more difficult one, because
yes,
one could certainly imagine a company that was really a DDoS attack that was disguised as slash dotting. And I think I may have mentioned, it's not the same thing, but it's in a way analogous, a talk I heard by somebody who claimed to have gotten his Kindle on Amazon to number one very briefly. And the way he did it was he had a bunch of fans online, and he told the fans, all of you buy the Kindle at, you know, 9:14 tomorrow morning or something. And apparently the algorithm for ranking Kindle sites is focused very much on recent sales, so for 3 minutes he had the highest sale rate of anything, and the theory was that in the fourth minute people will see this is number one, so they'll decide to try it too, and that'll keep it up high. So you could imagine, I mean, that's for a different purpose, but you could certainly imagine a case. What about a DDoS attack done without zombies? What's the legal status? If I'm trying to shut down your server, but the way I'm doing it is to get a whole lot of people who agree with me, all I'm doing is setting the time. What I'm saying is, look, that server is giving out information on abortion providers. Abortion is murder. Everybody who agrees that abortion is murder, how about at noon tomorrow we try to access that site and see what happens? Is that illegal?
What? I mean, wouldn't you be able to distinguish the conspiracy part of it and say, well, you guys made a conscious effort to do it, as opposed to... the problem is there's just so many people, and you'd have to find that person who made that conspiracy and maybe even find the communication.
But I want to know first whether it's illegal.
I feel like it's... Well, it's conspiracy.
Yeah, but what about the real space equivalent? What if I say, look... I mean, I guess one of the things I think that happened with this, I'm trying to remember why they forget it. It started out with Wall Street. What?
Occupy Wall Street.
One of the things they were doing at some point was having demonstrations in front of the houses of wealthy people in the New York area. So suppose they are explicitly saying, look, what are we going to try to do? We're trying to make these people's life miserable by having the whole street in front of them packed with people so they can't get cars in and out, so that it's noisy and walking is going to be a real pain for them. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. Is that illegal? Probably not, right? So is it the virtual equivalent of that? Yeah?
Well, wouldn't the virtual equivalent of what you're describing is more of a public place than rather than a private residence even? So the people outside the abortion clinic, can they physically barricade the door and prevent
no.
somebody from getting in? No, and that's what these people would be doing online, right?
Well, that's the question is, they aren't barricading the door. They're just trying to open the door and open the door and open the door. That is, putting it differently, is that more analogous to barricading the door or to just crowding the sidewalk outside so that in practice people can't come through?
Yeah, so essentially they're all going in and requesting handlers on abortion.
Right. That's right. It's the equivalent of that in a sense. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how you handle these things, but it's a case where you're doing something which individually is a legitimate thing to do, but you're deliberately having a large number of people doing it in order to have an illegitimate consequence. And that's the... Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's really not like trying to open a door over and over again. It's more like pulling the plug on... If you did it to a business site and took away their ability to make transactions, you're essentially like running away with their entire business plan.
Well, not with their business plan. You're just making it not work.
But
how different is that from deliberately having a demonstration which crowds the streets? So suppose the business is one which has walk-in customers, and we disapprove of that business. Again, the abortion clinic could be an example of that. So I get a large enough number of people who agree with me so that the sidewalk outside of their building is packed solidly. And if somebody tries to get in, we don't hit them over the head or anything. It's just going to be really hard to get in past all our bodies. And maybe somebody can do it, but it'll be hard and embarrassing and unpleasant. So 95% of the customers don't come. Is that illegal? Anybody know? I don't know.
I feel like in that instance, you could, as the business, try to get the cops to come.
To clear the sidewalk?
It wouldn't be... necessarily illegal to stand there, but it would be illegal to resist the police force. So, but
how many customers are going to want to come when there are police there and demonstrators there?
So the idea is that you would clear the demonstrators to let business resume.
Yeah.
But the problem is there is no online equivalent of that except to engage more servers.
Well, or to somehow find a way of canceling the zombies, that, you know. But all right, let me go on to my next question, which also sort of intrigued me. Suppose someone posts negative quote information, unquote. The quotes are because it may or may not be true information, about a company after selling the stock short. Under what circumstances does this count as illegal stock manipulation? Does the information have to be false? Consider a recent mini flap in the world of electric cars. And what, as far as I can tell, somebody on a blog posted the assertion that if you left an electric car unplugged in for long enough, the battery would die in an irreversible fashion, would be bricked, and it would then cost a lot to replace the battery. And as far as I could tell, the anguished cries from Tesla and whoever else was objecting about it never actually denied that it was true. That what sounds as though is happening is that they are saying it's very unlikely to happen because you have to leave it unplugged for a very long time, and what's the point of having an expensive electric car if you're not going to use it anyway? But that's not really an answer, because the answer is, yeah, I'm a rich person, I got an expensive Tesla Roadster, and then I went off to, you know, Barcelona for 3 months because I'm rich enough so I can do lots of touristing. And I came back and my Roadster won't start, and they tell me I got to pay them another $10,000 to replace the battery pack. What is this? So it looked like a case where I think, though I am not sure, that the information that was being complained about was in fact true, even if somewhat exaggerated. And then the question is, suppose you were able to find out that just before posting that blog post, the blog proprietor had sold Tesla stock short. Anybody know what the legal consequences are? Yep.
Well, that, in the case of the mini flap, I actually am hard pressed to find what the legal consequences of that would be, I think that...
Without stock sales, I can't see any.
Yeah, without...
I don't think there are even consequences.
With the stock sale, though, I can't really see what the legal consequences are either, because I think in that case, you're just depending on the common sense of the reader to assess, you know, the how extreme what you're saying.
Well, suppose it's entirely true.
No, it's entirely true, but it's remote. That
suppose it's not. Suppose you could take the limiting case of this is I have discovered something really bad about the main product of some company. Mm-hmm. So I announce the fact online. That's surely perfectly legal to do. It's admirable.
To a degree all the time.
And of course, and then the question is there any additional problem if just before announcing it I sell their stock short?
I don't.
What's the definition of an insider? I think the answer is I don't qualify.
Yeah, unless you're an insider.
I'm not sure how sharp the definition of insider is. Does anybody know? Suppose I'm the barber of the CEO of a company, and the CEO is a gossipy sort, and while I'm cutting his hair, he lets slip some facts that are relevant to what's going to happen to the stock tomorrow. Am I violating insider trading laws if I buy or sell on that information? I don't think so, but I'm not sure. Some of you might have.
Yeah, I think in this case, just in particular, when you're talking about batteries especially, they're stating kind of a fact of life with batteries in a very dramatic way.
Yes.
And probably in a very public way. So is that really, especially in this case, I mean...
But what one might be able to argue is not that they're stating it is illegal, but that they're selling stock is. That is, if you think about the insider trading cases, it's all the trading that's what people are complaining about, not the. But yep.
Well, as luck would have it, my computer freezes up right now. I was going to check a case, but this was from a business source.
Do you happen to know if your computer is being used as a zombie for a
game? I get that beach ball and my screen is black.
Yes, right.
Anyway, I can't be 100% sure on the outcome of the case, but it was an early insider trading where there was a guy who worked in the print shop. He was printing this articles, and the names of the companies involved would be blank, but he would still know, okay, this is going on, and read the articles and be able to tell what was happening. So with this information, he went and purchased some stock in the company, and a merger happened. He made lots of money, and he was sued. He wasn't liable for insider trading, again, and this is the part where I can't be 100% sure, but maybe misappropriation of this information. So that was an interesting
one. Yes, would anything different happen if the information was false? Let's suppose I post on my website that it has just been discovered that Tesla batteries are at risk of blowing up. And indeed, that yesterday the owner of who I name, purely imaginary, because it's a whole bogus story, but Mr. John DuPont, who bought the third Tesla Roadster ever out, was blown up along with his wife and small child when the battery exploded. So this is pure. I've invented the whole thing out of whole cloth, but I've also sold Tesla stock short. Am I liable? Anybody know? Yeah.
That's kind of the classic case where the SEC Rule 10b-5 applies and would be liable.
What does the rule say?
If you're spreading any false information that affects the stock, the price of the stock, and you're buying or selling that stock, as long as the information is material and affects the stock price, then you have liability.
Right. Note that one virtue of its not being liable for true information is that it gives people an incentive to release true information. Indeed, it's not entirely clear that insider trading should be illegal. The argument for insider trading is to say we want the market price of stocks to reflect their real value. If there's information relevant to the value which only the insiders have, letting them trade them when they buy, that drives the price up. When they sell, it drives it down. That means the price better reflects it. So you could argue that you're actually serving the function of the market better by doing that. And in this online case, you could say, well, why should I go to all the trouble of checking out very carefully whether such and such a story is true and then publicizing it? Aha! Because I can make money, because if I check it out carefully and it turns out to be true, then pretty soon I'll put up my report. There will be follow-ups. The follow-ups say, yes, indeed, Tesla batteries do get bricked, so the stock will go down and my selling it short will make me money. So you could imagine that this kind of stock manipulation could actually be a good incentive for getting people to generate information. That we have the sort of general problem that when you generate information, most of the benefit goes to other people. It's hard to treat information as property because once you give it to one person, you can give it to somebody else. So maybe this is a clever, indirect way of paying people. All right, we're running out of time, so do something else Wednesday. Just waiting for the first story about some ex-student of mine who commits some possible computer crime suggested in discussions in class.
So, I found a snag form.
Very good.
I pretty much have my thesis.
You do? All right. Which is?
That
you don't have a title on it.
Oh,
really?
So when do you the final draft has got to be submitted? Do you know what the date is for the end of exam period? Let me just say end of exam period because I don't remember.
Yeah, and then I think I can have a rough draft to you after the break.
All right. Does the rough draft this first? You mean the first draft?
Yeah. I'm sort of on outline phase right now.
Great. Fine. Sounds reasonable. And I'm supposed to sign here, I think.
Lisa, I'm sorry. Where?
You need a copy of this, too.
Second floor, law firm services, you just walk in and pluck it out.
This thing?
It's right by the side.
Okay, and does it have the guidelines on it? Because I'm debating whether I want to do it or not.
They're online.
They're online?
Yeah.